in that acute situation where you have a child with possible sepsis, don't forget your basics.
I think the main thing that we've learned is to really listen to parents.
What makes the experience better for them is when you take the time to just explain what is going to happen.
Nobody will ever berate you for asking for help. Sepsis is my responsibility.
Hello, and we've actually gone through this whole long journey learning about sepsis, and we've got to our final podcast. So hello from me. My name is Emma Lim, and I'm a general paediatrician at the Great North Children's Hospital, and I'm here with Monica, one of our junior doctors.
So my name's Monica. I'm a teaching fellow in paediatrics at the Great North Children's Hospital this year. And welcome to the Paediatric Sepsis Podcast, brought to you by the Royal College of Paediatrics and Child Health, Medisense, and Health Education England. So this series of podcasts aims to cover how to recognise, investigate and manage sepsis.
We hope this series of podcasts will answer all the questions that you've been too worried to ask, you've thought about, but you've never actually voiced them. It's like having a consultant in your pocket. Monica, we're like at the final hurdle now. This is our last sepsis podcast. And I just want to summarise a bit all the different things we've been through. So what kind of take-home messages have you learnt from listening to all our experts?
So it's been quite a learning journey. I've learned more about sepsis in the last 2 months than I ever thought I would learn before. So firstly, it would be good to maybe recap what we've learned about recognition of sepsis. And I think the main things that we were worried about initially was picking apart which children with fevers are the ones that are going to become septic and which ones have got your regular viral infections that can go home and will be better in a few days. I think the main thing that we've learned is to really listen to parents. Parents know their children way better than we do. They spend all day, every day with their child. And so when a parent says that something isn't right, it's really important to believe them.
I think that is so true. And it's really interesting that the NICE sepsis guidelines included that as something that they were worried about, but the adult sepsis didn't take it up as much as in the paediatric world. So they've actually learnt from our experience, and now they're rolling it out as something to think about, that you should listen to parents and carers for elderly patients and adult patients. When I listen to Caroline and other parents, everything she says rings true. This idea that you listen to parents again, and you don't just listen to them, you make them part of your team. You listen to what they say and you actually act on it.
I think that's really important, making them part of the team and involving them in the management of the child, keeping them up to date, making sure that their views are listened to. And for instance, if a parent tells you that a child is difficult to cannulate, and you don't feel confident in doing it, then getting extra help early is something that is really important to do. So little things like that is important. And I think that's what we've really learned from speaking to our expert parents as part of the podcast.
And we recently did a piece of qualitative research about what parents thought and their views on paediatric, the emergency department. And one of the things they said is they don't mind waiting. They know they have to see a lot of doctors. But what makes the experience better for them is when you take the time to just explain what is going to happen, even if you don't know. So you say something like, you are likely to wait 4 hours. During that time, we will be taking repeated observations. We will be taking blood tests. These blood tests take an hour or two to come back. You might go home or you might stay overnight. And that's the kind of information they want. And that's the kind of information that reassures them that you have listened to them and you have a plan.
And I know that we're all busy and we don't do this enough, but just that signposting about where we're going to go next with their child is just so important and can help to reassure so many families.
And last thing about recognition is recognition for the parents, so that when you send that child home, that parent feels really secure in knowing what to look for if their child gets worse. So having written and verbal safety netting, being clear with the parents when you want them to come back, where you want them to come back and what for.
And having things like patient information leaflets in your departments are super important in helping to give parents a succinct piece of information and advice that they can take away with them.
And don't forget, you can use online resources, including websites such as NICE, deteriorating patient and sepsis websites. Moving on from recognition, management, you can always learn from other people. Tell me what your take-home message is. What did you learn?
So I think the first thing to talk about is fluids. I think in medical school, you always learn that in an unwell patient, in a septic patient's, the point is hammered home about fluids, fluids, fluids. The patient needs fluids. It's part of the sepsis six. It's part of your resuscitation. And it's something that is your reflex action. Unwell patient equals fluids. So listening to Mark has made me think about fluid management and more judicious use of fluids in resuscitation. For example, giving too much fluid initially could have long-term consequences for that patient should they require further management in an acute intensive care setting. And that wasn't something I'd really thought about before.
Yeah, I think it all goes back to do no harm. Before anything, think about what you're doing. I think we have this reflex that we want to do something. It makes us feel better. But sometimes, as my grandmother called it, you have to do masterly inactivity. So, for example, give a small amount of fluid, reassess the patient. How do they seem? Are there any signs of fluid overload? And then give the next small bolus.
And I think we get it banged into us all the time about giving 20 mils per kilo, but there is no harm in giving a little bit first and then giving the rest if you feel like it's necessary. You can always give more, but you can't take away what you've already given. And that's a really important point, I think, that you have to remember.
Excellent. So fluids, cautious approach, inotropes. We all love a bit of adrenaline. Adrenaline's coursing all over the place in sepsis.
But again, it was something that as a junior doctor, I did not feel confident administering, prescribing, making up. And I think listening to the team talk about inotropes, in particular making up adrenaline, has been really, really helpful in boosting my confidence in perhaps considering it earlier on than I would have previously.
Yeah, I think you have to remember, we hardly ever use adrenaline. It's a rare thing that we use and it takes time to make up. And I think that Mark's point about make it up, because it's going to take you half an hour to make up an adrenaline infusion. And it's cheap. So if you want to throw it away, it doesn't really matter. And Mark's point about having it ready when you need it is so important.
And another big important point is if you're not confident to make it up and you don't know where to find those guidelines, I've learned exactly where I can find them by contacting my intensive care team or my transport team who will have that information at hand. And that was something, again, that I didn't know before recording these podcasts and listening to Mark, is where to find that information.
Absolutely. So for us up in the Northeast, that's Nectar. In London, that's CATS.
And other transport services all around the country, wherever's local for you, will have that information at hand whenever you need it and wherever you need it.
Great. And on to antibiotics. This is always such a controversial topic. You get as many opinions as the people that you ask. So what did you take away from listening to Andrew and Lucia?
So I think which antibiotics to give is a really big deal. And so we always go for our third generation cephalosporins in children that aren't, you know, known to us or is their first presentation. But being able to ask questions about previous allergies, have they been into hospital before, have they grown anything before, is a really, really important point as well. For example, parents often know if they've grown a certain bug before, and you'll be surprised how many parents do know what a child's sputum has grown before, what a line has grown before. So it's always worth asking the questions.
Absolutely, I couldn't agree more. Ask questions, ask about allergies, ask if they have a central line, ask what they're colonised with. Is this a hospital acquired or a community acquired infection? And phone a friend. Your microbiologist is sitting there all night with nothing to do but answer your call.
And I think as a junior doctor, sometimes you get very nervous about calling other specialties. Sometimes you get very nervous about calling microbiology. You always make sure that you have your e-records open, that you've got the child's obs at hand. But remember, that's their job. They're there to listen to you. They're there to look up that information and help you process it and help you with what antibiotic to give. That's their job and they're really keen to help.
There's no such thing as a stupid question, actually. It's always a good question because you actually ask the question.
And better safer to have asked than given an antibiotic that is maybe inappropriate for that child.
Absolutely.
So, Emma, let's think about allergies. That was the other important point that our team made.
Yeah, I think this is a growing field. It's always important in that acute situation where you have a child with possible sepsis, don't forget your basics. So ask if the child has an allergy. This is not the time to be making the situation worse by giving them an antibiotic that they could be allergic to. Think about later on whether you can delabel them, whether you can refer them to your allergy unit, whether that possible penicillin allergy isn't actually a penicillin allergy, because that's saving money for the NHS for the future.
Keep in touch with exciting new developments in the Paediatrics 2040 project to develop a credible vision for the future of paediatrics at www.rcpch.ac.uk/paediatrics-2040. This podcast was brought to you by MediSense Medical Education. Learn medicine differently through podcasts, games, videos, role plays and more at www.medisense.org.uk.
So Monica, when you think back to the beginning of the year when you started this job and you hadn't made all these podcasts and you hadn't had me banging on about sepsis, what do you think has changed in a practical sense for you?
I think confidence, firstly. Having a child present that is potentially septic, I mean, still does, but to a lesser extent, strike fear into your heart. At the minute, now, having done all of the podcasts, I do feel more confident with my approach to antibiotics, with the practicalities of phoning the microbiologists, with the practicalities of administering fluid and the practicalities of prescribing and drawing up adrenaline, all of which I maybe wasn't as confident before. So I feel like from that respect, I've come a long way in terms of knowledge.
When you're sitting at home having a chat over some hot chips, what would you tell your friends who are about to start their on-call tonight? What would be your sepsis hot tips?
So escalate early, ask for help. Nobody will ever berate you for asking for help. Consider fluids early, consider inotropes early. And most importantly, ask the parents, what is it that isn't right about your child? What is it that you want us to know? What is it that you're worried about?
I think that this is something that is really important because as much as you can think as an individual, what can I learn about sepsis? What can I do about sepsis? I think we're not individuals. We're part of a department. We're part of a team. And so I guess you have your responsibility as an individual, but you also have a responsibility as part of that team about how you can move your whole department forward in thinking about and dealing with sepsis. So what sort of things, what sort of cultural changes or what sort of cultural awareness has helped you? What have you noticed in our hospital that helps you be more aware about sepsis?
It's just on our radar earlier. So with all children that come in with a fever, everybody does start thinking about it earlier. We have our sepsis pro forma that if children meet a certain criteria on their observations, that sepsis pro forma is put into place in their notes, which gets everybody that sees that child thinking about it earlier and thinking about, could this be sepsis? And if so, why? And if it is, what are we going to do about it? So it's on everyone's radar just much earlier since the introduction of that.
Yeah, absolutely. I think having a protocol or a pathway where everybody knows what to do as soon as you recognise sepsis and how to help you recognise sepsis is absolutely the most important thing you can have. And also those little prompts all over the place. We have little cards in our lanyards that go through sepsis 6.
So all of the junior doctors have got these sepsis cards that they can put onto their lanyards that highlight the sepsis 6 and red flags for sepsis that were made by MediSense a few years ago. And everybody has those, so everybody's always thinking about it.
We also have really simple things. So there's prompts on our paediatric early warning score. So at the bottom near temperature, it says think sepsis on the back of our Pew's charts. It also takes you through all the red flags as well. So we have the same information in two or three different places. But when I think about it, these things help, but they haven't had the impact that our sepsis films have had. We approached four families who'd all experienced sepsis in different ways and made films with them. And we asked them a really simple question. We said, what could we learn from your experience of sepsis? And we made a film about that. And actually, just showing those films of parents to staff made more difference than anything else, because you remember the stories.
So, Emma, as paediatric trainees, and with sepsis becoming ever more important, how can we as trainees make a difference? How can we change culture to get people thinking about it earlier?
Well, I think it's so important because you're so much less boring than I am. So you always have really interesting, innovative ways of doing things. I think that the one thing that you do so much better is you understand social media. And you use social media, and you know how to get this information out in bite-sized chunks in interesting ways. And I think that's something that as young junior trainees, you are really good at. This is your strength. The other thing I think about is it's all about the parents. What we think is not necessarily what parents think. And I think when we do our best work, it's work with parents. It's when we co-produce something and we ask parents, what do you think would work? What do you think makes a difference? What do you want to tell doctors? That's where, when these two things come together, us and parents, that's when the magic happens. The other thing that I'm really passionate about is that it's not practice without perfect. So I want to talk a little bit about the role of simulation in sepsis.
So I think fortunately we don't see full-on septic children that often in practice. And so there has to be a way of practicing it before we get to the real deal. And I think simulation is such an important part of medical education these days. It gives you the opportunity to practice these situations before you get confronted with a real patient with a real life case of sepsis. So I think even in medical school, as you know, very junior students, throughout your training, I think attending courses that are advocates for simulation, that let you practice simulation, that let you practice those scenarios in real time with real equipment in really realistic settings is a really important thing that you can take charge of to help your own learning.
And actually, I don't think it's the high-tech sim you need. So you don't need all these fancy dolls that breathe and move and blink. Actually, it's the low-tech in situ simulation that makes so much difference. So, for example, I think you and I were doing a simulation on sepsis, and instead of doing it in the resus room, we did it on our paediatric admissions unit. So it was a little bit away from anything useful. And we just used a doll. And it was the really simple things. It was the fact that when one of our trainees walked up to the desk and said, my child doesn't look very well with his doll, there wasn't actually anybody at the desk for about 5 minutes. I think it was the fact that when we got in the room where we were going to do this simulation, things that you might expect, like oxygen wasn't there. We had to just change things around a bit.
They just got faced with a situation that they wouldn't normally be faced with in that setting. So yeah, they were in a lower resource environment.
So I think it was the fact that people actually had to put down their lunch and come out into their normal working environment and suddenly do something in an area that wasn't necessarily equipped for a full resuscitation that makes it so important.
And I think there are so many learning points from in situ sim like that. So thinking about, actually, we weren't prepared for that. What if that had been a real case? We wouldn't have been ready. And thinking about taking it seriously as well. So although you're there and you can see that it's a doll, thinking about who is going to do what, how can we work as a team to make this situation better? I know it's a doll, but it could not be. And we need to be ready for the eventuality that there is an unwell patient in that low resource setting that we need to deal with.
Yeah, and there's some really simple things, like one time we couldn't open the resus trolley because it had those plastic tags. You should be able to twist them, but actually you can't, so you have to go and get scissors to open it. The other one we picked up on, which was a really simple one, was somebody put an intraosseous needle in and then they didn't really know how to stabilize it or how to tape it down. That's something you can learn really simply before the event.
And I think these situations do really help to highlight those little learning points. So how to open the crash trolley, how to open the drug boxes, how to secure the IO. All of those things that you really don't want to go wrong should you be faced with an actual unwell patient.
So I think that this kind of in situ sim, this reveals all the human factors that can occur in your department and that you can't see on a day-to-day basis because you're blind to that, because that's your norm. Monica, the other huge barrier to successful sepsis management and recognition is the fear factor. We're scared of doing the wrong thing, we're scared of missing something, and it can involve the coroner and families and devastating outcomes. So how do you think we need to overcome that fear?
So I think the fear is a multi-level thing. I think there's fear of doing the wrong thing, and as a result, some people don't do anything at all. And I think there's fear of missing, and so maybe potentially over, kind of being overzealous with management. And I think in terms of fear, you just need to take a step back and really look at what you've got, the patient in front of you. The first decision you have to make is this child sick or are they not sick? And often speaking to parents, getting a senior involved early and looking at that child and seeing whether or not they're playing or whether they're grey and mottled can help you to make that decision quite early and help you make that decision about which arm you're going to go down. Is this child sick? Is this not sick? I think people get scared about calling a senior. They get scared about going down the wrong pathway. If you think it is sepsis, it's never the wrong thing to get help, to escalate, to manage as if it was. Better to treat it than miss it.
Absolutely. And I think you should never be scared to ring and get help. Even if it seems like you're going to bother somebody, you have to weigh up making a phone call against a child's life. I think it's really important to remember you are part of a team and the team will support you and that it's their duty to be there for you. So part of what you do is to get somebody else's opinion. I think sometimes we're scared that help won't come. I think that if you are out in a district general hospital, it's not the same feeling as if you're somewhere where you do know that somebody can be with you fairly quickly. So there is a level of fear when you're out in the community, say in an ambulance or in a district general hospital. Like, for example, here you might be in North Tees and it might take somebody more than an hour to get to you, by which time lots of things could have happened. And I think that is a scary place to be. And it's all about ringing, getting help. There are people who can help you and there are people who can direct you what to do. But you need to give them a ring first of all. I think I feel quite emotional about this now that we're coming near the end of this podcast series. And I've spent so many years thinking about sepsis. And it doesn't surprise me that I've learned so much, even though I'm a consultant, because whoever you talk to, they know things that you don't. And it's about asking those questions. And it's about being open. And it's about picking up the phone. And it's about making that relationship with patients and with other people. And that's when we come together as a team to actually beat sepsis. So what does it mean now? You've heard all these things. What does sepsis now mean to you?
So sepsis means more to me now than it ever maybe did in the past. I think the main thing that sepsis means to me is sepsis is my responsibility. And not just my responsibility, sepsis is the responsibility of everybody in our healthcare team. It's the responsibility of the junior doctors who are the first patient people clerking the patients. It's the responsibility of our seniors to respond to our junior doctors' worries about certain patients. And it's everybody's responsibility to pick up the phone, to phone for help, to phone the microbiologists, to do the tests, to encourage people to be part of research for the future to try and get towards a diagnostic test for sepsis. It's the responsibility to listen to parents, to listen to patients. It's everybody's responsibility, Sepsis equals a sick child, and sepsis equals our responsibility to save that child's life.
The Paediatric Sepsis Podcast Series was brought to you by the Royal College of Paediatrics and Child Health and Medisense, with support from Health Education England.